During my first visit to Europe in 1973, I had the honor to encounter another of the 20th century's great minds, the philosopher Sir Karl Popper. Like myself, Popper was once in exile from his native Vienna during the period of Nazi rule, and he became one of the most articulate critics of totalitarianism. So we found much in common. Popper was an old man when I met him. He was over 70, with bright eyes and great intellectual sharpness. I could guess how forceful he must have been in his youth from the passion he showed when we discussed the question of authoritarian regimes. In this meeting, Popper was more worried about the growing threat of communism, the perils of totalitarian political systems, the challenges of safeguarding individual liberty, and the sustenance of an open society than he was interested in exploring questions pertaining to the relations of science and religion. But we did discuss problems concerning method in science. My English was not as good then as it is now, and my translator's not so skilled. Unlike empirical science, philosophy and method are much more demanding to discuss. As a result, I benefited less, perhaps, from my opportunity to meet Popper than I did from meetings with figures like David Bohm and Carl von Weizsäcker. But we struck up a friendship, and I saw him again whenever I came to England, including a memorable visit in 1987 for tea at his house at Kenley in Surrey. I have a particular love of flowers and gardening, especially of orchids, and Sir Karl took great pride in giving me a tour of his own lovely garden and greenhouse. By this time, I had discovered how great Popper's influence was in the philosophy of science, and especially on the question of scientific method. One of Popper's principal contributions lay in clarifying the relative roles of inductive and deductive reasoning in the postulation and proof of scientific hypotheses. By induction, we mean building to a generalization from a series of empirically observed examples. Much of our everyday knowledge of the relations of cause and effect is inductive. For instance, on the basis of repeated observations of the correlation between smoke and fire, we make the generalization that where there is smoke, there is fire. Deduction is the opposite process, operating from the knowledge of general truths to particular observations. For example, if one knows that all the cars produced in Europe after 1995 use only lead-free gas, when one hears that a particular car belonging to a friend was made in 2000, one can deduce that it must use lead-free gas. Of course, in science, these forms are much more complex, especially deduction, because it involves the use of advanced mathematics. One of the areas of reasoning where Buddhism and science differ lies in the role of deduction. What distinguishes science from Buddhism most in its application of reason is its highly developed use of profoundly complex mathematical reasoning. Buddhism, like all other classical Indian philosophies, has historically remained very concrete in its use of logic, whereby reasoning is never divorced from a particular context. In contrast, the mathematical reasoning of science allows a tremendous level of abstraction, so that the validity or invalidity of an argument can be determined purely on the basis of the correctness of an equation. Thus, in one sense, the generalization achievable through mathematics is at a much higher level than is possible in traditional forms of logic. Given the astounding success of mathematics, it is no wonder some people believe that the laws of mathematics are absolute and that mathematics is the true language of reality, intrinsic to nature herself.